Now, continuing our monthly soundbite segment in partnership with Sauce Magazine, I'm Alex Hoyer, one of the producers of the program. Continuing our conversation with Corey King of Perennial Artisan Ales, with Ted Kilgore, owner and co-founder of the soon-to-open Planner's House, and Ligaya Figueres, executive editor of Sauce Magazine. So there were some drinks in the on-air segment that we didn't get a chance to try, and you all brought plenty more with you, and we want to try a couple more. And I think we'll start with you, Corey.
Perfect. I have a Berliner Weiss from Berlin. It's called 1809. It's actually 5%, so that's strong for this style. The style is traditionally 2 to maybe 4%. So if you guys, I guess everybody has a little one to try. Super effervescent. This one, you'll get much more, a higher carbonation level than the two we tried earlier. We tried a Prussia from Four Hands, and we tried a Peach Berliner Weiss from Perennial. Really nice notes on the nose. Sometimes a little bit of banana, which is traditional from maybe the underlying yeast that they used. Softer on the palate for sure. But this one actually comes from Missouri. We only can get two Berliner Weisses in Missouri that are actually from Germany.
Why is that?
There honestly are not that many producers of Berliner Weisses still in the world. Traditional Berliner Weisses in Berlin. There's more producers of Berliner Weisses now in the United States than there are in Germany. We have three locally, and I'm probably forgetting one or two maybe. I really need to make sure about that. But I know for a fact we have three. I brought three of them today from St. Louis area.
Mm-hmm. Now, before I taste this, I know that a lot of people wonder how to taste a beer. Run through briefly how I should taste this. Probably not in a paper cup like I have right now, but tell me how to taste a beer.
First thing is when you pour the beer into your glass, give it a visual inspection. You'll be able to tell the carbonation level of it. A larger head will form. Sometimes it dissipates. Sometimes it stays around. You'll be able to check the clarity, whether those proteins in there are from wheat maybe, or that's yeast in there. So you give it a little visual inspection to kind of prepare your palate. Smell it like you'd smell a wine. Smell it before you taste it. Most of our taste is through our nose. Everybody, whenever you're smelling too, keep your mouth open. That actually will help with the smelling of the beer. Swirl it around, get the aromas out of it before you drink it. Don't drink out of a pint glass. It's the worst glass ever to drink a beer out of. If you have one beer, pour it into a pint glass and pour it into just a wine glass and try them side by side. You will like the beer in a wine glass more. So that's one of the big parts of tasting. Make sure you have proper glassware too. And then, finally taste it. Is it bitter? Is it sweet? Is it dry? Is it malty? What's the carbonation level? Does it linger? Is it pleasing? There's all kinds of different things you can pick up in beer, because in beer we have no rules pretty much. We could put whatever we want in beer that's safe to consume. So you can get a lot of different flavors out of beer.
Okay, and so now remind me what I'm about to taste right here.
Okay, so this Berliner Weiss, you'll get a soft wheat note. It's the base beer, Weiss. It's a wheat beer, but it's tart. There is a lactic acid fermentation that goes on in it. Produces a natural acidity. Very nice for aging. Very refreshing, extremely refreshing. Like I said, most of them are low alcohol, so they're meant to drink. Traditionally in Berlin, you'd be offered a shot of Woodruff syrup beside it or raspberry syrup to cut the sourness and up the sweetness level of it. A lot of people now are just putting the fruit in the beer at the beginning, as we do at Perennial. I prefer them straight up or with the fruit already added. I don't like to add a syrup to my beer. Mm-hmm. I prefer it.
And you're completely right. You taste the acidity at first, but then the fruit flavor comes through a little bit more.
Super soft.
That's an interesting, I don't know if texture is the right word, but.
Yes, it is. That's a great word, because the wheat mm-hmm. adds a huge texture. Anybody likes a Hefeweizen, the base beer underneath this is very similar to like a Hefeweizen, very creamy, big mouthfeel with mm-hmm. high carbonation.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that. Now, Ted Kilgore, what are we going to try from you next?
Well, I don't have any more cocktails to mix up, but I actually just decided that the first beer we tasted would make a good beer cocktail, which I'm not a huge fan of usually, mm-hmm. but since these beers are such so high in acidity, they make a good replacement for acid, which is lemon, lime, balsamic vinegar, grapefruits, anything like that. So I actually just took a little bit of our rum mm-hmm. and added some Big O ginger liqueur to the peach beer we tasted. It's pretty darn tasty. It could stand a dash of bitters, but see what you think.
Okay.
The Big O, I brought four, three spirits and one liqueur with me today. All of them are local. One is the Big O. And one reason why I brought it is because it's become kind of a go-to mixer for bartenders around town. You'll find it any quality, like craft bar in St. Louis seems to be carrying the Big O, and you'll see it as an ingredient in numerous cocktails. And it just seems to have they would say the je ne sais quoi, like the guys seem to just go to it as giving the nuance that they want. So it doesn't surprise me that among the four, you know, spirits or liqueur that I had here, that Ted chose to use the Big O for just adding it to beer.
That's what we I would refer to as a modifier. So generally speaking, building cocktails, you have a base, a modifier, and then enhancers. The mm-hmm. base is usually whatever, like the beer is based on this. We use an enhancer of a little bit of the rum clement rum and Big O ginger, just building on the flavor of the peach and the citrus. So it's all about building kind of profiles. But the big difference in the Big O, it's a ginger liqueur, but it's more than that. It's a ginger and spice liqueur. So you've got a lot of other ginger liqueurs that are monochromatically just ginger, but the Big O has like clove, orange, allspice, cinnamon,
and
a lot of different notes.
Legay, you just gave me the Big O?
Right, just so that you can taste the Big O on its own. It's highly drinkable. There's so many things that you can do with it. It's nicely gingery.
Mm-hmm.
They hand chop that. It's a husband and wife who own that company, and mm-hmm. they've really just, you know, brought it up from the ground kind of thing. And they hand chop all of the ginger themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Normally I think of ginger as sometimes being kind of harsh, but I find this smooth
mm-hmm.
and
pretty soft.
And subtle mm-hmm. as well. That's a good taste. Ted, you didn't come expressly prepared to make anything else, but I'm sure you didn't know all of what would be here, but you've just taken a bunch of different things and tried some things. I imagine you might try to do that a lot.
That's exactly how it works. I really just try to enhance certain flavors, and we do a lot of like bar choices. These days, the bartenders are a lot better trained, so a lot of people that are in the more craft cocktails or classic prepared cocktails, they don't want to think too much about it. They'll give me a mood, or the craziest thing, I think if someone came in and asked me to make them something that tasted like their wet basement in the summertime. So I used some funky Jamaican rum and some scotch, some smoky scotch, and a few other things that were kind of grassy. And
yeah.
And the guy was like, yeah, that's exactly it. That's what I wanted. So yeah, it's a lot about building things. The cool thing about mixology and making cocktails is you can take all these different things, emotion, taste, flavor, smell, aroma, and make that an experience on the fly if you kind of pay attention to what each spirit or ingredient's saying mm-hmm. to you.
So. And in some of the notes that Legaya sent over before we recorded this, she called you one of the best bartenders in St. Louis. I'm curious, what is your background? How did you become interested in mixology?
I was a enthusiast. I always wanted to bartend. One of the coolest things, I think, I really kind of thought, well, I think I've kind of chosen the right career. But when I was 21, I was working in a different industry, but I bought a Mr. Boston's Guide. And in 2009 and 2010, I actually had recipes in the Mr. Boston's Guide. So that was like, yeah.
Oh, but wait a minute. I think this is really, I'm going to tell a little bit because people maybe don't know it. Didn't you at one time work for a perfumer?
Yes, I was an industrial perfumer for 12
so
years.
So already, if you think about working in the perfume industry, those smells are so nuanced. I think I'm certain, Ted, that you picked up like a keen ability to, you know, differentiate, you know, aromas and smell. You were doing the same thing with spirits, or you do it with wine or beer, and it's just one, I mean, it's one characteristic or element of that particular liquid, but still.
I think it's a huge thing that a lot of people don't see. The beer people, wine people, food people, they all have the same kind of process for tasting. I break down tasting. I've spent a lot of money and a lot of time trying to learn how to analyze every little nuance that's in the glass. But if you do it the same way with food, it kind of crosses over. Like foodies are really cocktail people or really beer people. It's just all a matter of, you know, how you approach it.
So it really is a science, but it seems like there's so much more to that. I was looking at a preview of the documentary that we're talking about in the third segment today, and one of the quotes was, blood, sweat, and tears, but you also put your heart and soul into it. So that sounds like there's a lot of emotion and just guts that goes into this?
There's been a lot of studies. People come in, they have drinks from me, and they have drinks from other bartenders, and they go, I don't know what it is. Something you're doing is different, but we measure, you do the same thing. There's a lot of people that talk now about how you feel when you make the cocktail. The end result is the cocktail's either bitter if you're angry, or, you know, if you're happy, you love that person, you're pouring your love into it, then it's going to taste sweet. And that comes across a lot. And the Japanese have actually taken to a different level. They have what they call the way of the cocktail, where people study under certain masters, and it's all about taking care of the customer. And that's really boils down to, like, when people come to my bar, it's like I try to teach all my people, the bottom line is you really have to pour your heart and soul in that drink and want that to be the best drink that you can make for that person possibly. Mm-hmm. And that's really the big difference in a lot of bartenders, is their, you know, willingness to go that extra mile for the customer or anyone. That's the same with a chef, the same with other artists or people that really care about what they do.
Right. And LaGaia, I think we have time for one more.
Sure. Drink. Well, let me talk about this one real quick. Pinckney Bend Distillery. This is also...
First of all, I want to comment on the bottle. Mm-hmm. It's a tall bottle, and the label on it looks like it has some type of a ship's steering wheel.
Right, and there. You'll see there's like the Pinckney Bend with the river and the connection at Pinckney Point. This is based out of New Haven, Missouri. Mm-hmm. They originally started, they're just a few years old, again, like many of the local distillers here regionally are, small batch type of production. But they started with a gin, Pinckney Bend gin, and I brought their corn whiskey, which is very lightly aged, so it is a white spirit.
Because normally I think of whiskey as having a caramel color.
Right, it's going to be aged. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So this is, I can't say that it's unaged, but it's just, I think it's been lightly aged just for a few weeks. And actually I'll pour you some if you want to try it. What I'm excited about for these guys, I think they put out a quality product, but on top of it, right now they are part of, they're growing, and among, like, you know, local distillers are we're seeing them get distributed in other places outside of Missouri and Illinois. And these guys, Pinckney Bend, is actually right now part of a small Missouri Department of Agriculture trade delegation exploring export market opportunities in China. So they're in China. Oh, wow. So, I guess they think it might be time to go international, which is pretty neat.
I actually just read a review on gin.com. I forget the website exactly, but it's a group out of London that reviewed gin, and they gave this a really good view. I don't know how they got a hold of it, but it was
their Pinckney Bend gin got
London blog.
Yeah, it's a great gin. I like their gin a lot, but like I said, this one is their corn whiskey, and so you'll taste some of that, so the sweetness on the corn in there. Mm-hmm. I think it has some nice character to it.
Yeah, and I always define a good whiskey, at least for me, by what the aftertaste is, like the taste that it leaves in my mouth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It does. There is a buttery texture to it that when you're just drinking it all by itself, it does coat your mouth a little bit. It's not a harsh whiskey at all. So for an unaged whiskey, I find it to be really nice.
Mm-hmm. And Ted, the difference between a corn whiskey and a rye whiskey, I've heard some things about this before, that something can be called a corn whiskey versus a rye whiskey just if the percentages of what's in it is just a little bit off.
The labeling is like the corn whiskey. This is labeled corn whiskey. That means this is 100% corn, and it's unaged. The American government regulates that. If it's moonshine, it can be a blend of whatever. So this is actually a corn whiskey. It can't be labeled corn whiskey unless it follows those guidelines. So bourbon, for instance, has different guidelines. It is partially corn, partially rye, and a little bit of barley. They also use wheat sometimes, but it has to be 51% corn. Rye whiskey, 51% rye. The rest could be made up with whatever else you want.
Yeah, I just think that's interesting.
And the bourbon has to be aged also for...
minimum of 2 years, rye and bourbon.
I recently lived in Iowa not too long ago, and there's a whiskey up there called Templeton Rye. And I don't know if you've tried that.
Absolutely.
But that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's that's an interesting brand. There's a lot of companies now that are actually... starting brands by buying a product and then starting up their distillery afterwards. And that's what Templeton was actually, their first run was made in Indiana.
but mm-hmm. it's a great whiskey. And they're starting to produce it themselves now as well. That's 100% rye, which is it's really floral. A lot of white flowers and kind of a bouquet in there, which we don't get a lot right. in whiskeys.
And I should mention that the reason why it was made in Indiana is because the liquor laws in Iowa weren't updated, and they have since changed
right.
in Iowa. But all right, any final words from anyone?
I'm kind of I think we're done drinking with our drinking yeah. session.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad that we're able to do this extra. Hopefully we can try to do a little bit more of this down the line. I've been talking with Lagaya Figueres of Sauce Magazine, Corey King of Perennial Artisan Ales, and Ted Kilgore, a bartender and owner and co-founder of the soon-to-open Planner's House. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Thank you.